You may be seated.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're here on case 2014-358, sitting for Justice O'Donnell. Is Judge Cynthia Rice from the 11th District. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you.
The case is Janine Lycan et al. Versus the City of Cleveland for the appellant, Mr. Singletary.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the panel. I'm here today on behalf of the City of Cleveland to argue for a reversal in the case of Lycan versus the City of Cleveland. This case was before the 8th District Court of Appeals on a class certification issue. The city appealed the trial court's ruling favoring class certification. The proposition of law we've put before the court recognizes two things. One is that this court back in 2006 considered on a writ of prohibition whether the city's traffic camera enforcement ordinance 413.031 was an adequate remedy at law. The court so found, and the reason the court found that is because one, it provided an administrative hearing, and then secondly, the individual had right to an appeal to the Common Pleas Court after if they wanted to further appeal. Subsequently, the plaintiffs, there was a case called Dixon and Campbell versus the City of Cleveland. That particular case addressed the issue of whether lessees were legitimately receiving notices of violation from the city. That issue was litigated, and in the decision Dixon Campbell versus Cleveland in 2009, the 8th District Court of Appeals found that the city had been misconstruing its ordinance and that owners were not allowed, or that lessees should not be receiving notices of violation. The class of plaintiffs in this case before this court are represented by six individuals who were lessees prior to the decision in Dixon and Campbell, who received tickets, civil citations, and who then either on behalf of five of them, they voluntarily paid. They did not contest. They did not seek an administrative appeal. What they did was they, and Your Honor, excuse me, but I forgot to, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay.
If this was just a class about people who did appeal, then
I'm sorry, Your Honor, this is a class of people who did pay and did not assert their appellate rights under the ordinance.
But if what if you had a class of folks who did assert their appellate rights? Would that qualify?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's an interesting question because if you had people who had asserted their rights, I think the issues would have been litigated to their conclusion as opposed to the case that's presented to this court wherein.
So there's no subset of individuals who could ever bring a class action?
Under the circumstances presented today, no. And the reason for that is because they knowingly waived their right to an appeal.
So we have those who waive their right to appeal. They can't be here, or they can't bring a class action in the Common Pleas Court. And those who exercise their appellate rights, and so there's finality to those, and no class action there. So that leaves no one, right?
Well, Your Honor, I'm unaware of anyone who did appeal under those circumstances other than Dixon and Campbell. But the Dixon and Campbell case is instructive of what would have happened, which would have precluded any need for a class action. Because as this court found back in 2006, the ordinance provides an adequate remedy at law. Now, similar to the Lycan case was the matter of McCarthy / Carroll. Mr. McCarthy was the
so lead. It's really not a matter of finding class members. There's just no substantive case, period. Right?
Correct, because res judicata would bar anyone from so proceeding, Your Honor. And we believe that this particular case presents a claim preclusion issue. And the reason for that is that there was finality here because you have an administrative appeal process wherein the individuals who received their civil citations knowingly waived their right to appeal when they made their payment. If one looks at the citation they received directions at that time saying directions for how to admit and directions for how to deny. And one admits when one pays, and that is clearly spelled out on the citation. Plaintiff appellant's or appellee's argument here that somehow they preserved a right of appeal by paying, it makes no sense whatsoever under these circumstances because their original appeal wasn't even filed until more than 2 years after the fact.
Mr. Singletary, you mentioned that there were six individuals and you said five of them had paid. What about that other person? You didn't finish that.
The other person, I may get the name wrong, I believe it's plaintiff task, but she received a citation just like the others and she did nothing. What she did was just received it, did not seek an appeal, and did not pay. Now, if one looks at both the ordinance and at the citation itself, you'll see that, again, to deny, I request a hearing, my vehicle was stolen, or the vehicle was not in my custody and care. Those are the three options one is provided at the time the citation is received. Now, the court, the 8th District, when it considered the res judicata issue, actually did not find res judicata, but in a manner that is at odds with the very argument that is being made by the plaintiff appellees in this case. What the 8th District said was that a traffic citation, in this case a civil citation, is so de minimis or inconsequential that one doesn't have any inspiration to appeal, whereas the Lycan plaintiffs, appellees in this case, are actually arguing that there was some sort of oppressive system in place that they thought it better just to go ahead and pay to keep
the
city from...
Well, counsel, the Court of Appeals said that there's no res judicata because there was never an actual judgment. Do you contest that?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I believe that...
Who rendered the judgment?
The parties at the time the transaction was completed, similar to a consent judgment wherein what one
consent,
has to understand
wait, is counsel, hold on. A consent judgment has the signature of a judge on it.
Well, Your Honor, in the Grava case, this court has recognized that an administrative hearing process does provide for res judicata effect. And that was a case where a Board of Zoning Appeals addressed a variance issue and denied it.
So you're saying there's a judgment in this case that should be afforded res judicata authority?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that there's finality in this case that should be afforded res judicata when a plaintiff comes in and admits liability in a situation like this to not feel that an admission of liability is tantamount to res judicata would open the city or any municipality across the state to thousands and thousands of appeals. Well,
I understand the Chamber of Horrors. My problem, though, is that in order for res judicata to apply, there had to been an ability to litigate what's before us today. And you're certainly not saying that someone would have brought the constitutionality of red light cameras to the parking bureau, are you?
No, I'm not, Your Honor, and especially not in this case, because the plaintiffs in this case aren't claiming unconstitutionality. What they're claiming is the law itself was misapplied. It's an equity issue that's before the court, and there's no issue of constitutionality applied. That's what somewhat distinguishes this case from the Carroll case, which is the McCarthy case before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals on a second occasion. In that particular case, the plaintiff, in a matter which is viewed as a copycat litigation by the plaintiffs in this case. They not only claimed unjust enrichment under an equity theory, but they also attempted to bring causes of action based on the Constitution.
I understand, counsel. I don't mean to be argumentative this morning, but are you suggesting that unjust enrichment and a declaratory judgment are issues that could have been presented to the Parking Violations Bureau?
Well, Your Honor, the only unjust enrichment issue that's presented is their voluntary payment and trying to get it back. At the time they litigated this case, they would have had every opportunity to argue they should not have paid that particular fee.
There are people that might contest the voluntary aspect of that payment.
Well, Your Honor, all I can say is this court has considered the city's ordinance in the past and found that it presents an adequate remedy at law and presents the fact and presents under 2506 an appeal process. And Your Honor, I see my first 10 minutes are up.
All right, let me ask you before you sit down, there was, you know, things that had to be alleged by the individual who was served with this citation that would get them out of the obligation. One, I wasn't driving, my car was stolen. I forget what the other one was, but those were the only defenses, so to speak, available that you could allege.
Well, Your Honor, the ordinance itself maintains other defenses. If you were to request a hearing, you could also raise that, for example, that there was a funeral procession, that there was a policeman that waved you through a police vehicle.
So it's a case-by-case type of analysis that you would put forth for if you wanted to challenge this with the... but subsequently, then, there's the ruling that says that a lessee is not the appropriate person or to be served for this, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. My understanding is that if you, post or subsequent to that, if the appropriate owner of the car is served or is served with a citation for the red light, there's a relationship with the lessor that they will reimburse for those traffic offenses. Is that customary?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Who's leasing the car that says, you can't serve me with a citation, even though I may have been the driver or someone under my control was driving that vehicle, they still are going to have to reimburse the lessor, or excuse me, the lessee.
If there was a statute enacted that said you couldn't serve the actual leasing company itself.
Right.
At the time that these tickets, the civil citations were issued to lessees, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles was identifying lessees as additional owners of the vehicle, so that when the city, the process, the administrative process involved, the owner's address was the lessee's address, and that's where the ticket went. The ticket specifically identified you as the owner of the vehicle. That's why the Dixon Campbell case is so important to the understanding here, is that the administrative process did provide one who received a ticket with the opportunity to challenge and to raise the same issue that's being now presented subsequent to Dixon and Campbell. In National Amusements, which is a case some years ago where this court was addressing an excise tax or an admissions tax issue, this court reiterated, and I think I've heard it in the cases before you this morning also, that a change in the law does not change the impact of res judicata. These plaintiffs have specifically disclaimed any fraud, any tort, anything but unjust enrichment in an effort creatively to get around the effects of the res judicata effect that their admission. One important thing, and going back to Justice O'Neill's question earlier, with regards to the information, the legal process involved here, our ordinance provides that the ticket itself is prima facie evidence of the violation, so that when an individual, such as Ms. Lycan in this case, received the ticket, she had the prima facie evidence that was going to be used at her hearing before her.
Which was the photograph from the camera that they supply to you with your ticket.
On the ticket itself, there's a photograph, and then it provides you with a website where you can go and actually see the video itself.
And they've done that.
And so she knew what the city had as far as prima facie evidence. The legal process had begun. The legal process is ongoing. She chooses not to challenge that legal process and pays. The city receives her payment. There's finality. Can you imagine the reverse of that situation where if the city was to now contact Ms. Lykin and say, you owe us $100, I'm sure she would claim, no, I've paid that. There's finality to this. The city can't come after me. And we're saying that once you pay, knowingly admit, whether it's a mistake of fact or not, you've waived your right by virtue of res judicata being applied. And if you review our brief, you'll see there's a case out of the District of Columbia called Kovach, where it explains the distinction between the application of res judicata and collateral estoppel with regards to either issue preclusion or claim preclusion. In this case, the analysis is the same undertaken by the Sixth Circuit with regards to the claim preclusion that's raised, because everything could have been litigated. It's the same parties, the same issues,
right,
et cetera. Thank you.
I have one question, please. How would Ms. Lykin know about the Dixon and Campbell decision when she paid her fine, or anyone like her? How would she know that it was an improper citation issued by Cleveland?
Well, Your Honor, she paid in 2006, I believe, so Dixon Campbell wasn't until 2009. So she would not have known about Dixon Campbell at the time she paid.
Okay, how about the people that are in the class after 2009? How would they know?
No, Your Honor, the class is limited to March 11th of 2009 before, because in March 11th of 2009, the city amended its ordinance, mm-hmm. which goes to the heart of the city surreptitiously trying to cite lessees, when in fact the city immediately amended its ordinance after the 8th District's opinion in the Dixon and Campbell matter.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. My name is Paul Flowers. I represent the plaintiff appellees in this case, Janine Lykin. I thought I'd start with Chief Justice O'Connor's questioning with regard to when it came about that the ordinance was found, the former ordinance was found to have been exceeded. That is, that the city's ordinance didn't allow lessees and other non-owners to be cited. And that didn't arise with the Dixon and Campbell case. That is a reality that the city knew from day one. Ms. Vargas, Maria Vargas, was their Rule 30B5 representative. She is the head of the Department of Citations for the City of Cleveland, and she's the person who runs this program. And she says in the summer of 2005, we knew we could not cite non-owners. We decided we were going to anyway. That was a policy that was adopted in writing in their business rules. And that just undercuts the entire defense that's left in this case, because no one was going to win those hearings because that was the city's policy.
So you say that the city, by their read of the statute that empowered them to do this, knew that there was an exclusion for lessees?
They knew they could only cite owners, because the word owners was in the ordinance.
Okay, and so they admit that their interpretation of owners was wrong?
Correct. So that's what Ms. Vargas said.
Well, she said, we knew it was wrong in 2005, but we still did it anyway. Or we knew that we could only cite owners, and so we cited lessees.
I'll read her testimony just so there's no mistake about it. She says, and this is on page 114 of her deposition, question, so if these people didn't know better, they're going to get a notice and some would pay, correct?
Lessees being these people.
Right, lessees, correct. Answer is, that's correct. Question, and you guys took their money even though you knew you weren't allowed to take their money. Answer, that is correct. And that really set it all up here, because this was something they took a flyer on, they ran with for 4 years. It finally took the Court of Appeals, not their administrative review procedure, the Court of Appeals to say, no, that's not right. You could only cite you could only cite the owners. And then that's when you get the change in the ordinance.
And they didn't at that point say, well, geez, we better refund all that money that we've given to, that we've taken from lessees.
Not at all. And in fact, Ms. Task was mentioned. She's the woman who didn't pay her ticket or appeal. They have not released her of that citation. I mean,
okay,
she
but
technically
they haven't
still
collected
owes
on it either.
Excuse me?
They haven't collected. They haven't pursued her.
I don't think after the lawsuit was filed. They were before.
Okay. So you have a situation where there's an administrative interpretation on the city level saying, you know, we probably can't be citing these people, but we're going to do it anyway. We have the 8th District Court of Appeals in Dixon, and they say in 2009 it has to be the owner of the vehicle, not the lessee.
Correct.
All right, so then Cleveland changes as of that. They're, but up to that point, up to 2009, when this group of litigants, or lessees, let's call them, there was nothing to stop them from pursuing an appeal of the citation based on the fact the statute says you cannot cite me, and they didn't do that.
Right.
Okay, when you know, Judge Rice asked the question, who was going to tell these folks? Well, the law's on the books, and not everybody is given a tutorial on all the laws that are out there, and you know, if you feel that you're wronged, you have the ability to hire an attorney and pursue it.
Right. Hire an attorney, challenge a $100 citation within 21 days. There's no filing fee for that challenge, but what they were doing is that after 20 days, they would tack on a $20 penalty. After 40 days, they'd tack on another 20. So everybody owes 60 days before that appeal process can be completed.
Well, I don't think that they would... I don't think that the penalty for appealing it is they're tacking on additional dollars. Wouldn't the appeal stay that?
No. There's nothing in the ordinance that says that they stayed those. Ms. Vargas said, well, we would have.
Do you know that there's a practice of they enhanced the penalty for and penalized you for appealing?
Yeah,
do you know that that happened?
Oh, it's in the record. That's from the Dixon and Campbell case. They pursued them relentlessly while their appeal was going on. Aggressive letter saying, you know, you owe this, you pay this. And it's important to note that the ordinance, there's nothing in there, first of all, that allows a stay. And there's nothing in there that says if you win or if you lose, we'll waive these. Now,
okay,
obviously.
But if you, there is the provision that if you pay this and you appeal it, we'll refund it.
If you win.
If you win, sure.
Right. And it's the catch-22. If you lose, you no longer owe us $100, you owe us $160. And plus your credit rating's ruined.
Okay, but I mean, I guess smarter way would be, here's my $100, hold it in escrow. We're gonna figure out if I'm right or you're right. And if I'm right, I get my $100 back.
Right, first of all, that takes a very sophisticated claimant. And second of all.
Well, we had the Dixon and Campbell, were they not?
They were sophisticated, true. But just my second point is that the rule is, once you pay something, your appeal is moot. You know, so that's kind of I think that's what they're going for.
Well, that's not really true. Once you pay it, the appeal is moot. If you win, you get your $100 back.
Oh, no. That's in a part of appellate procedure these days. And I don't think it's right, but that is the rule. If you have a judgment and it's satisfied, you lose your appeal, even if it's satisfied involuntarily. But we kind of digress here because the real point is here is what would have happened if they'd done all that? And the answer is nothing. Ms. Vargas said very clearly in her deposition that everyone was going to lose those administrative challenges because that was their policy.
And then what could they do?
Then they go to the courts.
Right.
Which is where Dixon Campbell got relief after a lot of stress, aggravation, a very tumultuous trail. That's where they got it. Not through a review procedure. Not through them. They got no right to say, hey, Dixon Campbell did it. Dixon Campbell did it through the courts, not through their hearing process. And you know, there's a reason they don't mention Ms. Vargas until the tail end of their reply brief, and you didn't hear anything about her now. Her testimony makes this case unique. This is the case where we have established conclusively, in my view, that this hearing process was not designed for these types of claims. She's right. I mean, these hearing processes, they're correct. They're good for looking at the merits. Was that really the car? Did they read the license plate right? Was there a funeral procession? Blah, blah, blah. These hearing officers, who are not lawyers, can decide those. They're not there to decide whether the policy they're expected to follow is accurate and whether or not restitution is owed. That's not their function. And so, yes, in the Scott versus East Cleveland case, this court said that these are appropriate mechanisms for satisfying due process, but that was in the context of the merits of the citations. This court didn't give carte blanche to these hearing review boards to decide every issue and any issue that could possibly come up. And that's the distinction here. You know, all these other cases that they're citing, they don't involve testimony like this. They clearly establishes the futility of pursuing these hearing review boards. And that's still the law in Ohio. This court has not disturbed Kaufman versus Newburgh Heights that says that while administrative hearing processes are mandatory, only to the extent that they can afford the relief granted. That's Kaufman versus Newburgh Heights. And they're conceding that. I mean, they have only one example. It's the Dixon and Campbell case, which produced this one. And in that case, their hearing process didn't do anything. It was the courts that provided the relief. And that's what we're seeking here. This case, I think we have gotten to the nub of this. The propositional law is based on res judicata. And I think the reason why we've got this exhaustion defense, which is the real issue, exhaustion, the reason it's being dressed up as res judicata and collateral estoppel and standing is because they can't win on it. Because that's still the law in Ohio, that exhaustion only applies when they show the relief could have been afforded administratively. And that's not the case here.
Although if they had gone through the administrative process and then gone to the Court of Appeals, or I'm sorry, gone to the Common Pleas Court appealing that, that's the forum that could have straightened all of this out, correct?
In theory, correct, but that's just fantasy to say that, you know, these people who owe $100 are going to pay another $100 for the 2506 appeal, the $100 filing fee. They're going to hire a lawyer. They're going to go through all that one at a time, and the courts are going to be able to handle these one at a time, and that's how we're going to get relief.
The whole point is that the Dixon case actually did straighten it out so that the city is no longer doing that. So it was done through the Common Pleas process. I mean, it was handled, it's been changed, and your individuals chose not to go through the steps to reach Common Pleas level.
I think they chose not to because that's the only practical decision. I mean, they were going to be hit with additional penalties. They were going to be hit with these collection efforts by the city lawyers. It was not practical for them to pursue an avenue that is futile. I mean,
but the Dixon Campbell case, that was just one plaintiff, correct?
One lessee, correct?
One lessee. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a class action.
Right.
It is doable. It was done. The record was straight. Cleveland responded appropriately to the court order. So for you to say it's not practical to use the remedies that are available, you're saying they didn't want to do it until this lessee came forward and did it. But this, just because they chose not to do it doesn't mean that they were precluded from doing it. There was a remedy available to them.
Right, a remedy that's not realistic under the circumstances. And that's what Kaufman versus Newburgh Heights and countless other decisions say. It's not enough that there is, in theory, this hearing process. It has to be able to provide the relief expediently and
the
appropriately.
The hearing process in order, you're right, the hearing, the administrative hearing wasn't going to give them that relief because, as you said, these are non-lawyer hearing officers. They're just checking off boxes and they're not, they're looking at the printout and they're asking the questions that are relevant to what their duties are. But you can't stop there just at the administrative process. You have to say what was the complete package of remedies that are available to these lessees. And the court is the complete remedy.
It is, and that's what I have a hard time with is why they're taking credit for Dixon and Campbell. That the 2506 appeal is not part of their hearing process. You know, it's not part and parcel. There's nothing that says that you have to go through the administrative hearing and exhaust all your judicial appeal procedures. It doesn't. They don't say that. Just the administrative hearing is there to try to get it straight before you go to court. That's the only reason.
And you have to do that. You can't go straight to court. You have to exhaust your administrative remedies, right?
Provided that they can provide the relief sought, which is Kaufman versus Newburgh Heights.
Okay.
Counsel, they're not disputing.
But don't you have another response to that line of questioning? I'm looking at Prairie Township, Lamar Outdoor Advertising, where we've said ex parte administrative determinations can't form the basis of res judicata.
Correct.
It isn't that, I guess I would see that as maybe a stronger response to this line of questioning. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And it gets us back to the whole res judicata issue that the Justice O'Neill brought up in the first place, and that's what this propositional law is that how can you have res judicata when you don't have a judgment? And the answer is, well, you've got this implied judgment between the parties and so forth, which isn't the law.
But don't those cases also stand for the principle that an appeal where you get to go to court and you might have a full hearing at that point, that's not enough. What we have to look back on is, was there this judgment in the first place and that ex parte administrative judgments don't count,
right,
basically. Do I have that right?
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, I agree. And I think, you know, there's a number of flaws in their theory, but the one that keeps getting me is just the practical nature of it. I mean, if we're going to say that, hey, if they set up this system and it's pointless, it's never going to work, but everybody has to go through it one at a time, and then everybody has to exercise their 2506 appeal, which requires a lawyer and a filing fee and all that, then we're going to see this all the time. I mean, this is what Justice Pfeiffer was alluding to, I think, was that you can't have a class action when they set things up that way. They've immunized themselves from a class action. And they know full well that nobody's going to go through one person at a time and seek relief. And then that's why they took a flyer in this. I mean, you know, if somebody goes through it and they win, we'll give them their $100 back. That's the way it worked, and they collected a lot of money over it. So this case really boils down to responsible government, you know. Are we going to expect municipalities to abide by their own ordinances, cite people only when they're entitled to cite people, and then expect them to issue refunds when they exceed their authority? That's really what this case is about, is responsible government. So we submit the 8th District got it absolutely right, and we'd ask you to affirm.
Thank you. Nelson.
Your Honors, I would ask you to go to the city's reply brief and look at where we address Ms. Vargas's testimony. Clearly, there's a misrepresentation, probably unintentional. I'm not saying it's intentional, but Ms. Vargas was testifying as to the non-owner driver, which she said the city did not have the authority to send a ticket to. She was just wrong. A 30B5 testimony is not an admission, it's just testimony like any testimony that can be challenged or looked at again. What Ms. Vargas was addressing was the issue of whether as we talked about earlier, to deny, you can also say someone else was driving the car. Then the ticket is sent to that someone else who was driving the car. And if they say, yes, I was driving, they can make payment. If they say no, then it reverts back to the owner of the car. What Ms. Vargas was testifying to, and she was just incorrect, was whether a non-owner driver of the car would be liable to the same civil penalty as the lessee or the owner of the car. She was talking about someone who's not a lessee and someone who's not an owner. The driver.
And was the city, well, the city wasn't sending those people any kind of notice. They wouldn't even know who they were.
Only if you check the third block on the citation that says, and there's an affidavit on the ticket
okay,
form itself.
So that would be the actual titled owner would check that box and say, I wasn't driving, but Mr. Singletary was, and here's his contact information.
Or the lessee driver at the time this ticket was issued as an additional owner, as identified. That's who she was addressing. It's not the lessees in this case. There was no cabal.
Are you saying that the testimony that was just read to us was taken out of context?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. Exactly. And you can look on page 18 of my brief, and you'll see exactly where we cite to that fact. And if you read before and after the sites they're talking about, you'll see it was addressing non-owners. Further, if you look at Ms. Vargas's testimony throughout, you'll see that she testified knowingly to the fact that she believed the city had the right to cite lessees because they were viewed as additional owners by the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. In the Dixon and Campbell case, Judge Cooney, in her dissenting opinion, recognized the same issue at that time. So this issue of the city knowingly, for some reason, sending out tickets to lessees when they knew they didn't have the right to do it is just false. The city immediately rectified its ordinance when the 8th District interpreted in a manner different from the city's interpretation. With regards, Justice French, to your question about an ex parte ruling, I don't believe there is an ex parte ruling here. There's a person who received the ticket, a person who had the evidence that the city had before them, and a person who knowingly, voluntarily made a payment. The court in Carroll spends multiple pages addressing this very issue with regards to Ohio law and with regards to the fact that one who knowingly waives their right, surrenders their ability to challenge, even under an unjust enrichment claim, what benefit was provided? Where's the equity in this case when someone knowingly speeded and now they're trying to get the money back? I know my time's about done, but with regards to the recent matter the court addressed in Walker versus Toledo, part of what the Walker decision addressed as part of the holding itself, in effect, said that one who foregoes their administrative appellate rights has no right to then seek judicial remedy. That was part of the holding in the case. And what one has to look at that in the context of the Jatka versus Cleveland case, which is presently pending before this court, on the same issue that was raised in Walker to some degree on the 1901-20 issue, which has been settled by this court. Further, in Jatka, though, this court, even though it held that it believed the administrative hearing process was unconstitutional, the Jatka, the same 8th District Court of Appeals, on the same date that the Lycan opinion was issued, they came out on the same date, there was one judge that was on both panels, that court said that the plaintiff would have no standing to proceed because he admitted liability by virtue of his payment. Now, the 8th District has considered the prima facie evidence in the past. It finds it to be legitimate and convincing evidence with regards to a violation. Speeding is well documented through the application of the mechanical issue. So, Your Honor, we think if one reviews this case law, given your recent Walker opinion and holding, considering the 8th District itself doesn't think of a plaintiff having the same standing as the Lycan plaintiffs has no standing, and if one looks at the Carroll opinion and looks at res judicata in the sense their claims are precluded.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.